go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. My name is Scott Benjamin. I'm the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com.
My name is Ben Bullen. I hang out with Scott. I write some videos. I also work here.
He does some stuff.
I do some things.
Mm-hmm.
I've been some places, man. I've seen some stuff. And we've actually seen some pretty crazy stuff.
We have. Yeah, that's right. And this is maybe one of the crazier things that I've seen recently.
Yes. And you showed these guys to me. And it's funny. I've just got to get this out of the way so I don't accidentally spend 15 minutes rambling about it.
Okay.
It's funny because I remember seeing toys that were built this way and as a child thinking, that's ridiculous. There is no way that would work. These people are condescending.
Yeah, and what's funny is there's a new toy now that, well, not new, but a few years old that is exactly the same.
Weird.
I know. So shall we dive into it here?
Let's dive into it. Let's talk about screw-driven vehicles.
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, this is one that I just stumbled upon on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because I really did. I was just kind of messing around trying to look. I was looking up all different kinds of things. You know how it is on YouTube when you're searching, like, all right, Bugatti Veyron top speed run. And then you find, like, you're looking at someone who's making a Pike's Peak run.
And then you find sidebar.
Yeah, and then everything, you know, all the related videos and and soon enough, you're off on a completely different tangent, and this one is something really unusual, and I don't even know why I clicked on it, but I did. It's called the Fordson Snow Machine, and we're talking about a vehicle from the, I'm going to say mid-1920s.
Yeah, 20s.
Okay, the mid-1920s, because I've seen dates that range from 1924 to 1929 on this thing, 1924, 26, 29. It's a really, really unusual vehicle, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, this is strange.
Yes,
picture this. It's a tractor, an old-time tractor, and I'll talk about that in a second, but it's a tractor that has almost like pontoons underneath, like on a pontoon boat.
Mm-hmm.
But they are screw-shaped. They have, the spiral screw pattern.
Like an auger.
An auger. That's probably the better way to say it. It's like two augers underneath this thing that are horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how this thing moves itself over the ground. This is really, really odd.
Let's hold on for the listeners who are going, what?
I know.
Because that's what I did.
Yeah, until you saw it, right?
Yeah, because sometimes I guess there's no other way to say it. In case people didn't know, most of the people who work here are kind of nerdy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get excited about stuff like this.
Yes.
And when you came up to me, Scott, and you were saying, hey, wait, hey, let's check this out. Or I came by your desk or something.
Yeah, you stopped by my desk and I was looking at this.
Yeah, and then we both went into nerd mode because these things still, I've read the design. I even looked at pictures of one of the patents. Still, somewhere in my head, I have a difficult time figuring out how these things move.
Yeah, they do move. And they move real well.
They move really well.
Extremely well.
Certain surfaces.
Yeah, that's right. On certain surfaces. That's right. Because we're talking about a snow vehicle.
Yes.
Mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it could also have applications for, dirt, grass.
And mud.
Mud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just muck. You know, like a mossy, or not mossy, like a swampy type environment.
I got you. I've got something for you.
Oh, later. Great. Okay, good, good. But really, this thing, it was developed to be a snow vehicle that would cross heavy, deep snow that, either loose or well-packed snow.
Yep.
The idea was that, they could haul logs with it. They could do pretty much anything that you could do on a farm in the summertime with this thing in the winter on skis or on sleds.
Sure.
So if you're hauling logs, like the video that I'm mentioning here, if you search for that term, that Fordson snow machine, you'll find this video. It's a 10-minute video, well worth the time of watching. It's a silent film. I think, you'll find versions out there that people have put, bad music too, but it's a silent film, with the slates in between that tells you what they're doing next, a demonstration of this thing, right? And you'll see that it's a tractor. It's a Fordson tractor from, the early 1920s, and also a Chevrolet automobile from the 1920s that they've applied this drive system to. And you won't believe how well this thing handles snow. One of the demonstrations, the guy is driving over what looks like, inch deep snow or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe a little deeper. Real snowy environment.
A couple inches maybe.
He hops off the back of it. He has a rake in his hand, like a garden rake. And he plunges the handle of the garden rake down. And this, the snow is, what, 4 feet deep, five feet deep?
But the tractor remains
right on top of the snow.
And it's heavy. It's a heavy tractor.
It is. It's a big, heavy tractor. And we're talking about a, again, this is a Fordson tractor. This is a, originally like one of those big old steel wheel tractors. If you can picture those from the state, you know, state fair or something that you may have seen. They were, I can tell you a little bit about the Fordson if you want.
Yeah.
Really, this is who you might think, Henry Ford, Ford and Sons. It was shortened to Fordson. Because in 1907, I think, Henry was trying to attempt to build tractors. And it was unsuccessful. It just wasn't working out for him for whatever reason. But his idea was that he wanted to make an affordable tractor for the masses, just like he wanted with the Model T, right? He finally, in about 1915, after, you know, all this, you know, I guess it would be about a decade of trial and error, he had something like 50 tractor prototypes in between that period, like between 1907 and 1915. And by 1917, he came out with the Fordson Model F. And the Model F was, I think he sold about, they say 750,000 Fordson Model F tractors were sold. Between 1917 and 1928, which was right around when the Model A came out. So at the same time he's building the Model T, he's building this Fordson tractor. And, you know, the, of course, mass produced, you know how many Model Ts there were? 15 million.
Yeah, millions.
Now he's selling tractors roughly at about the same proportional rate, you know, where he's selling 750,000 tractors is a lot. That's, that's more than any other one line of tractor. I'll screw this up, but it's like, any more than one line of tractor has ever sold before or since.
Set the record.
Set the record. And this is all the way back in, you know, the early 1900s, 1917 to 1928.
Still hasn't been broken?
I don't believe it has, no.
Ooh,
no, because this was such
Ferrari
a popular model.
Steamed.
Everybody needed a tractor at the time because it was an you know, agricultural society.
Sure.
So anyways, there were, and for a while they were produced in Ireland. You know, they were, I guess that was one location, Southern Ireland, Cork, Ireland.
That's weird.
Yeah, strange.
But they didn't have screws.
Well, they didn't have screws. No, this was just a tractor. Mm-hmm. And they used this, this company that did this, this Armistead Snow Motors Company.
Yes.
You just happened to use the Fordson tractor for their concept vehicle to show that this could be done. So, I mean, really, the only way to really get a good grasp of this thing is to go and take a look at it online, look at the video, and if you want to see one of these things in person, there's still a few of them around, these screw-type vehicles, and they're in museums. One that I happened to see on display that had been refinished was at the Hayes Antique Truck Museum in Woodland, California. So that's just one example, but there are a few rusting examples that are out in fields, you know, here and there. Collectors have them, of course, but so far I haven't seen many that have been restored.
There's actually there's a little bit of recent news with this because they – since they do have a longer history, they are specialized vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have uses. They're not that great on the pavement. They're actually really,
I can imagine.
Bad.
Yeah, because there's very little surface on that and it's metal.
Right. And its whole thing is to be able to – approach the ground in a different way to get a different hold on it.
I did see this one in that video. You'll see it on grass, tall grass, like in a farmer's field. And it can handle different types of terrain as far as, you know, hills. But it operated in much the same way on the grass as it did on snow. Better in the snow, but it's still capable, but not on concrete. I didn't see it on that.
Yeah, from what I hear, that's not what it's intended for.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you.
Well, it would just destroy it. It would pull it up, right?
Right, yeah. Because some of these machines have been designed to actually break roots of trees as they're driving over them propelling over them.
Oh, they're creating trails.
Yes.
Okay.
Trailblazers, quite literally.
Oh.
So there's this invention I want to tell you about called the Amphirole. Like amphibian. Amphirole.
Mm-hmm.
Around 1960, a guy named De Baker, I'm mispronouncing it. He was Dutch. He's in Holland. He was, you know, they've got a lot of canals, right?
Yeah.
And for a long time, depending on the tide, certain places would be underwater, certain places would be habitable or not habitable. This guy loved to fish. That was his bag. The thing was, his favorite fishing spot was in a really inconvenient location because when it was low tide, there was just clay at the bottom. And so it was really tough to walk on there. When it was high tide, you could fish, which meant that if you were, you know, Joe Schmo in a boat and boots, that you had to come in at high tide, grab all the fish you could, and then leave before you got stranded in the
limited
mud.
Time.
Yes, sir. Limited time offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invented this thing that is essentially a screw-driven vehicle. It's got the two
pontoons,
kind of. And they actually are floats. They have to be.
Oh, sure.
Since it's a fierce vehicle, but it still has the corkscrew design, and he can alter the angle of the floats. Yeah, alter the angle, and he could go through the clay. He could also do like sand and mud.
Oh, sand! You know what? That's a good point because I was wondering about sand.
Yeah,
it can cross sand, so any loose granular type surface it can cover.
I haven't seen the video, but I hear that they can handle sand pretty well,
mm-hmm.
Which makes me think they could handle gravel.
And what's cool is this thing can float too, so you can drive this through the water.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't think it'd be terribly fast.
No, I'm sure it's not. Yeah.
But at least you can move forward, backwards, sideways, any way you need.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It used to have a lack of power, so it actually probably was very slow.
Oh, I see.
But they replaced the engines and use rotary engines now, oddly enough.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so everybody wonders what that is.
Yeah.
Hey, download our podcast.
Rotary engines, that's right. The RX-7 engines, right?
Mm-hmm. And give us 5 stars if you're feeling charitable. We sure do love the attention.
Oh, Ben, what are you begging?
Am I?
No, I'm just
kidding. I thought, in my head, I was like, you're schmoozing.
Leave that to me. I'll beg.
All right. I'll schmooze you.
Please.
So, and then also the Ice Challenger, which is a British exploration, a British expedition, I guess, took a tracked craft, which would be, you know, like a snowmobile with a tread.
Yeah.
And they replaced it with these screw-driven things.
Wait, a snowmobile? You're talking about a small vehicle or you're talking about
a big vehicle, like a
transport-type vehicle?
Yeah, they called it the Snowbird 6.
Oh, cool. We've talked about those snow vehicles before. Those are incredible machines. Now, they've had some of these huge transport vehicles that are screw-driven, right?
Yeah, because they can't do long distances.
Oh, okay.
That's another con.
Oh, I see.
So pro, you can go almost anywhere in the wilderness. Con, not very far.
Okay.
So they apparently liked that it could be pretty much amphibious, but the distance was a huge problem.
Well, so also the Russian military has been big into this thing too.
Oh, this is my favorite.
Yeah,
part.
This is one that you can search again online. You can find this because it's one of the related videos. As a matter of fact, that's how I found it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to say ZIL. ZIL.
Yeah.
It's a military manufacturing center, I guess, or a group that builds vehicles for the Russian military, or did.
Built a lot.
Yeah, built a lot. I mean, we're talking trucks, tracked vehicles, mm-hmm. and this screw drive vehicle, which is the ZIL 2906. And you can search for that online, but this is really just a bigger, badder version of mm-hmm. what we saw in the Fordson video. When they put it on the Chevrolet auto body.
Yeah.
This is like a better version of that because it's a lot more stout.
And it's military too, so it's got a couple key differences, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it has the front skids that are much more adept at climbing
approaching angled surfaces.
That's right. Going over trees is what I'm talking about. Going through swamps, you know, heading down massive inclines, you know, with rocks and mm-hmm. Snowdrifts, things like that. Where the Fordson tractor looked a bit front heavy to me because the screws had to be tucked underneath the front of it. Mm-hmm. So it's real, real abrupt at the front, real tall, but it ends right there. The skids don't go out in front, the screws rather. In this ZIL vehicle that I'm talking about, the 2906, it seems like it's a little better balanced. It's a little lower, a little wider.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of different versions of this that they made as well, and I stumbled on these two. there are smaller snowmobile type vehicles that they made where they're two, these look terribly dangerous, by the way.
Okay.
You can imagine how close these screws are to you.
Yeah.
And they're not covered.
What?
They're not covered. They're open on top. So it seems like if your arm were to, you know, come out of the vehicle, let's say you go over a particularly rough snowdrift or whatever, and you hit a fence, it looks like your hand's going to go right into the screw of this thing, or your leg, you know, whatever,
yeah.
Cold weather gear might get tangled up in this thing, I would think.
Sure.
But they do look really cool. So just imagine a snowmobile with these two small screws in the back, and then it has the skids in the front like a normal snowmobile would have. But there were a variety of these. I don't know if they were ever produced or just concepts that were drawn out, whatever. One that might surprise you, there was a vehicle, and I wrote this down. Give me a second here. There was a vehicle that was made by Chrysler in 1964. That was tested at the Chelsea Proving Grounds in Chelsea, Michigan. And I found this on allpar.com, which is that site that you can go to for anything Chrysler, Mopar, anything like that, right? It's called the Chrysler Marsh Screw Amphibian Vehicle. And it was around 1964. And you can see, you know, still images of this thing. I don't know if any video exists or not. I'm sure it's somewhere. But this amphibious-type vehicle that Chrysler was testing in Michigan in the 1960s. And I think there were a lot of companies that really thought this may be a way to go for, you know, all-terrain-type vehicles, amphibious vehicles with military applications.
Yeah.
It's really not a bad idea. It's a good design. If you watch this thing in action, you can understand why it has incredible benefits over any other vehicle in the snow. Tracked vehicles included. You may think that, you know, like a tank can get over anything, but the problem with tanks is they tend to dig down.
Yeah.
And you'll find that these screw vehicles, they just float on top. In fact, you look at the path that's left by it, it's just really a couple of diagonal shaped lines that appear in
the
snow.
Slash marks.
Yeah, you don't even see tracks from this thing other, you know, not deep treads that go through like you would have find out with a car tread or something.
Yeah.
Or the tracks rather. It's more like just grooves that are cut into it, very shallow. And you're talking about a heavy, heavy vehicle that just crossed over the snowdrift, but there's not much evidence of it.
Yeah, it's so strange because it's really the distribution of weight that I think is one of the brilliant parts.
Yeah, and you know, of course, you know, military applications. We talked about this. Yeah. There was a vehicle called the Weasel that was used in World War II.
Was it a U.S. vehicle?
It was a U.S. vehicle.
Okay,
yeah, it's a U.S. vehicle called the Weasel, and it was a concept again though. But this gave rise to what we know as the M29 Weasel, which was a tank like vehicle with treads.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of collectors that still use these M29 or collect these M29 Weasels, and some people have big collections, but this is, you know, one area that they like to collect because these are popular vehicles, I guess. It was made by the Studebaker company.
Weird.
Yeah, Studebaker made the Weasels, the M29 Weasels. So, it was really, I guess the Weasel was a snow vehicle that could also float. And, they ended up making these things with tank treads and widely popular. You see them in parades and things like that now. But, another kind of cool vehicle.
I want one.
Well, you know, if you want one, there's a version you can get for $50.
Are you serious?
$50.
Is it a scale model?
It is.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's a RC model,
yeah.
Tyco.
Yeah.
It makes something called a Terrain Twister. And if you want to see a modern version of this, there's something called a Terrain Twister that's a vehicle that you can drive on snow, sand. You can drive it on concrete, though. That's the difference with this one.
It's probably light enough.
It's very light, yeah.
That's probably part of it.
And it's rubberized versus being
steel,
metal.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it doesn't have to be steel and stand up to really everything like, you know, the true military vehicles do. But, this is something you could drive right into the water. It's really a cool toy. I mean, it's like a boat land vehicle. And I've seen kids, you know, get in them on Christmas Day. They drive them on the snow. You know, use it in the springtime, drive it into the pond or whatever.
Scott, are you trying to tell me what you want for Christmas?
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah.
Well,
it looks like a fun toy.
Act surprised.
That's right.
Yeah. At least
I always peek anyways.
Yeah, yeah. Really?
No, not really. But I
told you to stop going.
I have an uncanny
stuff.
Ability to pick up a gift, shake it, and decide what it is.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should hang out.
Ruined a lot of Christmases that way when I was a kid.
I want you to help me ruin people's Christmas, Scott. Let's Grinch it up.
Sounds good. But that's about all I have really on these things. But screwdrive vehicles are really they've got a long history.
Mm-hmm.
They're still around. People are still kind of playing around with these, and collectors are definitely in pursuit of them.
Yeah.
You'll find stuff like this on Hemmings, Hemmings Motor News, you'll find blogs about this thing, you know, collectors, people that have spotted one that's abandoned somewhere in a field or in a museum somewhere. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're still out there, and it's something worth looking into.
Definitely, because the thing that still surprises me the most, despite my literal inability to understand how they could possibly work.
You know, I still don't get it either.
I guess it doesn't matter if we get it, if it works.
Simple machines.
I've read and reread how it works, and when I look at it, it just looks unreasonable.
It does. It does not look real when
it doesn't.
It looks faked.
It does.
The original film, the 1920s film, looks faked somehow, but it is real.
Well, instead of ruining people's Christmas, and buying one of these right away, let me take a break and think about it. In the meantime, let's do some listener mail. All right, Scott. So John writes in, and he is going to set us and the listeners straight, actually, on some stuff about submarines.
Okay, fair enough.
Now, you know, before we had someone send in some listener mail that named several other things about submarines. John has a few of these, he says, are rumors.
So this is a counterpoint to the point that we made before.
Point, counterpoint.
Got it. Between listeners.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're not in this. We're
just giving I'm distancing myself from this.
I could tell, man. me too. I'm just reading it, though.
Okay.
Hello, fellas. I'm here to put some rumors to bed. I was enlisted in the Navy for 6 years as a nuclear reactor mechanical operator stationed on the USS Los Angeles, the USS Greenville during this time.
Cool.
I can say without a doubt there is no maximum height requirement of 5'10". In fact, my best friend is 6'5", and he was stationed on the Los Angeles with me.
6'5" in a sub?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And he says the average height that he was of subs that he was around, or the average height, excuse me, of officers and subs he was around was about 6 feet.
Hmm.
No weight requirement. And he says he knew that because there were a few sailors that were kind of overweight.
That would have been me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said that while for 40 years females were not allowed into submarines, they've recently been stationed on some.
Oh, so wait, how long? 40 years?
Yeah, over 40.
So there was a ban on females?
There was a no female thing.
In subs for 40 years. Yeah. Okay, interesting.
According to John here, says you must be American born to work on subs only because you have to get a secret or higher security clearance, and more so because of the technology in the reactor compartment and radio room. The nuclear payload, he says, is very safely tucked away. However, the payload could destroy much more than New York. Just one of these missiles could destroy New York, and they carry more than five of them.
Whoa.
And there's no GPS, which I guess makes sense because people could probably track it. There are a couple of other things. The wire, he says that – yeah, he says what we do use is an inertial guidance system using gyros, and
it's not food, Ben.
And a few other, I'm just hungry.
I know.
And a few other things that I can't mention.
Yeah.
And he says, I hope this helps others out there who are hoping to get into a nuclear platform and are over 5'10".
All right.
So thanks so much,
Very
John.
Cool. Thanks for setting us straight. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's really good. I'm glad people write in with stuff like that with firsthand experience because otherwise, you know, we're just going on what the readers say. We investigate as much as we can, but how are you going to know about the height restrictions and things like that on military submarines?
And also, John, thanks so much for your service.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You ever read The Radioactive Boy Scout?
No.
Might want to pick it up.
Wait, that's about the kid who scrapes the watches, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a very short book. Mm-hmm. But definitely worth your time. It's called The Radioactive Boy Scout, and it was happening in Michigan while I was there, so I remember reading about this in the news.
I was actually an Eagle Scout, and we used to talk about this guy all the time as a kid.
Recently, is in the last 2 years, I've seen some photographs of this guy. He's been in a little bit more trouble recently.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's some scary photos, like police room processing type photos, mugshots.
Oh, no.
Face covered with sores from exposure.
Oh, man.
I know. And if that doesn't intrigue you, then I don't know what will. So just check it out. It's a fascinating story.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, let's try to segue out of this. The last stuff we need to talk about, right?
Yeah.
Is find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. Car Stuff. Hope you enjoyed this as much
as
we did.
Nice salvaging that one.
Is it salvaging?
I guess, yeah. I threw you way off no, with the book recommendation. It's like Scott's Book Club.
Scott's Book Club, and also our blog. And, of course, if you have any questions, I don't know if we have anything about the Radioactive Boy Scout on the site yet.
I doubt it, too.
But if you have any automotive questions that aren't answered on the site, or if you have something you'd like to hear in an upcoming episode, please send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.